Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for June 15th, 2009, and on this week's episode, Tom Williams interviews Wells Kaufman, president of the Ravinia Festival. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, and let's talk theater.
This is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. I have a very special guest this week. His name is Wells Kaufman. He is the president and CEO of the Ravinia Festival. Hello, Wells.
Hello, how are you doing?
Great. I must start out by congratulating you on the Camelot show that you opened up Ravinia season with. It was a marvelous concert.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was a pretty special night.
And tell us about... you initiated the theater initiative here because they hadn't done much theater at all, if I remember correctly, through the years here at Ravinia.
That's right. Back in the 60s and early 70s, there were two attempts, three I think total. Birmingham Shakespeare from England came and did a long run of a couple of Shakespeare plays. And then ACT out of San Francisco, Bill Ball's company, also came and did a couple of productions. We also had The Robber Bridegroom and Cradle Will Rock with John Houseman's acting company out of Juilliard, Kevin Kline, Patti LuPone, et cetera, in the 70s. But there hadn't been much more after that. And largely, it was because theater had really taken off in Chicago like crazy. If you think about Steppenwolf, for instance, they started in Highland Park. In fact, most of those guys were ushers at Ravinia and still laugh about the fact that they populated the restrooms of Steppenwolf in Highland Park with the toilet paper from Ravinia that they would steal, and the cleaning supplies in the basement of what I think it was a Methodist church.
Yeah, here. Basement of the church.
So there's a long history that way as well from a sort of grand larceny point of view.
So Gary Sinise maybe Gary Sinise to send his CSI people.
That's right. Well, you know, actually we did two tapings of the Regis and Kelly show here a couple of years ago. Oh. And one of the first guests was Gary Sinise, and he walked on stage with a whole a clutter of cleaning supplies to replace that which he had stolen every year from Ravinia. It was really a funny moment. But there hadn't been a lot of theater because those longer runs from ACT and from England didn't do so well. So when I got here in the fall of 2000, just come off of a really successful concert performance of Sondheim Sweeney Todd at the New York Philharmonic, which went on to win Emmy Awards and Grammy Awards and all sorts of wonderful things. It was just a great experience. Patti LuPone, George Hearn, Neil Patrick Harris, Audra McDonald. And we decided to recreate that here at Ravinia in the summer of 2001. And a lot of naysayers, a lot of folks saying, you know, theater doesn't work, no one's going to come, we're a music festival, we're a classical music festival, it's the wrong thing to do. Well, it sold out so quickly that we actually had to open up the dress rehearsal. We were not in a position then to add a performance because we didn't have the dates to actually do so, nor did we have the artist's availability. So since then, it's really taken off. I mean, we can't do a three-week run of something because our theater is so huge. If you think about the fact that our pavilion is 3,200 seats, I believe, for instance, Chicago Shakespeare is about 500 seats. So that's six performances there.
Yeah.
Plus the lawn. Okay. So that's a good long weekend run anywhere else in any other
That's
theater.
True. I never thought about that way.
And that's really how it works. And especially now that, as of this summer, we'll have video screens on either side of the stage for all of our pavilion shows. It really makes every seat in the pavilion a close-up seat.
Yes. Yeah. I noticed that. At the Camelot.
Camelot.
It really added... I mean, you could see. There's not a bad seat in the pavilion.
It's true.
But I mean, you can count the hairs on someone's head almost.
That's right.
You get that extra bit of
detail. Or as George Hearn would say, the lack of same. Yeah, on his head. You know, one of the things about that Camelot that was so extraordinary that I did not know when I booked George to sing King Arthur, and you know, we put the trio together: Sylvia McNair, Rod Guilfrey, and George, because they'd had such a good time.
And they were awesome,
fella. Weren't they? So
oh, fantastic.
I mean, Joe Sullivan Lesser said it was the best fella she'd ever seen, and that George was the best in the role she'd ever seen. And she was in the original
production. I've seen that several times. I saw, and it was probably the best I've seen of it. it's a shame that great productions, great performances didn't come with their cameras.
Yeah, yeah.
For that, because it would have had a lifetime.
Well, I think it's probably available on YouTube and any number of other pirated.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Everything we've done here has shown up within minutes on some sort of internet media at some point.
Well, let me ask you the question that several people have. And you sort of answered by saying that the 3200 and maybe what with the lawn, how many people could see a show on one night?
Well, we had
show.
A screen on the lawn, okay. Yeah. So potentially we could have had 16,000 people watching.
Okay. But a couple
a lot of people
yeah, have
it's
asked
almost
me
the United Center.
Why about like a weekend? Mm-hmm. You know, when you do it, when you have a full production where they're in costume or anything like the Gypsy with Patti LuPone and the...
Well, we did three performances of Gypsy.
Okay.
We only did one of Most Happy Fella, and we barely got to capacity. It's just not a piece people know.
It's an awesome piece.
It is an awesome piece. Yeah. But, you know, Camelot and Fella have something in common. They're both the shows written after the really big hits. So My Fair Lady gets to Camelot, and Camelot was a hit in its own way, but certainly not the success of My Fair Lady. And Most Happy Fella comes right on the heels of Guys and Dolls.
That's right.
Most Happy Fella is a painful, challenging, emotional love triangle that has light moments and wonderful dancing moments and things like that.
It's really
like
an opera, too, I think.
It is an opera. You need great singers.
Yeah.
The thing about Camelot that's so tricky is that, and George Hearn was talking about this, is that Lerner and Lowe and Moss Hart conceived of Arthur as a non-singing role. But, of course, there's a lot to sing, and George sang it beautifully the other
night.
Yes,
and he sang it versus
sang
talking
it. That's
like,
right.
Like a lot of
Richard
people.
Richard Burton or Richard Harris.
Yeah, right.
Or, for that matter, Rex Harrison in My Fair Lady, right?
Right.
Though Arthur is more of a singing role than the My Fair Lady lead. That said, the problem with the piece is that you have all this dialogue in Camelot. Because the actor playing Arthur wants to be able to act, and so you need a lot of spoken word for him. You don't need that when you have a great singer like George, and so the concert performance we did, I think, was truly magically done by Mark Robin, in that he really took everything out that you didn't need, and you were left with the score.
It's one of the things Mark is really good at from doing, you know, shows at Marriott and so forth. He knows how to cut it. He did a Joseph not long ago where he actually had it on under an hour and a half, so we had to kind of add back to it with dance, but that's good on a lot of shows.
I think it works extremely well. And yet he's very musical, so he doesn't cut any of that stuff. And he's understanding of what book you actually need there to keep the story going. I don't know if you know this about George and King Arthur. He was the understudy for the original Arthur in the national touring production in 1963.
Great. Great bit. I didn't know that.
And neither did I. Yeah. So when I booked him, I thought he'd make a great Arthur. I didn't know that he'd already learned the role. But he had never sung it before last Friday night. Because the guy he was understudying was a Christian Scientist who never got sick, ever got sick. So he was in the show. He did one of the smaller roles, but he never got to sing Arthur. It took him 46 years to get from learning it to actually sing.
Well, he looked like he was really having a good time.
He had a wonderful time. Yeah.
And tell us about the big voice of Lancelot.
Rod Guilfrey, huh?
Yes.
So I've known Rod since he was an apprentice singer with the Los Angeles Opera back in the 80s. When he was just getting started and understudying and then moving to lead roles in things like Barber of Seville and Billy Budd and Tales of Hoffman, the villains, all of which he's a star in. But he's always loved the American musical theater, as has Sylvia always loved the American musical theater. And both had great opera careers, and Rod is still singing Figaro's and things like that. But Rod looks like a Lancelot.
Yes.
And
he's a good actor. So is Sylvia.
Really
That's rare. Sometimes you know, right, you either go for the opera voice or the actor. Right?
That's right. Yeah. It doesn't actually link too much. I think we're fortunate in the opera world these days to have so many terrific singing actors on the opera stage, like Renee Fleming or Nathan Gunn or Natalie Dessay or Kari Tamatala. I mean, these are people who really understand the acting.
Yeah, only in the last few years did I start covering, like, opera heavy, like the lyric and so forth. And I was impressed with that, too. I remember years ago when it was the fat lady singing.
Yeah.
Or it was some prima donna star
who,
if he didn't sing, he'd go sit down. He
That's
wouldn't
right.
act.
Yeah,
he
the just whole... wouldn't. Whole park and bark thing,
which
is still pretty—it's still pretty common in Europe.
And is it?
It still shows up every once in a while. I mean, sometimes you just want that voice, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, if it's somebody who's just going to go sit down or walk off stage or needs water on stage or whatever it might be, there's still a few of those, especially in the Wagnerian operas, which, of course, you can just stand there for an hour and a half. You know, Birgit Nielsen's great line about Tristan and Isolde. young singer said, so you're the greatest Isolde of our time. What do you really need to have in order to sing this role? And she said, a really good pair of shoes for act one. Because you're just standing.
Yeah, that's true.
And mostly looking around.
And I just saw that this year, and you're absolutely right.
Wasn't it great?
Yes.
That was Debbie Boyd.
Yes, it was very good.
That was maybe one of the best Tristans I've ever seen in terms of singing. And that Hockney sets are just out of this world.
And people were telling me, if you're breaking into opera, and I'm new to the opera world, and the older I get, the more I appreciate it. They said, don't go to Wagner. They're long and they're boring. They were so wrong. Of course, I don't listen. As soon as they tell me that, then, of course, I have to go.
Because it's a great, great story. Yeah. But those sets and those actors, Cliff Forbes was a brilliant Tristan. We've had him here a lot at Ravinia. We've had Debbie here a lot at Ravinia as well. And not only do they sing it beautifully, they don't look like they're struggling with it all the time.
Yeah.
And the orchestra, the Lyric Opera Orchestra, is just playing the pants off of everything. And what Andrew Davis has done with this ensemble is truly incredible. And those sets are really amazing, too. That rake stage, very difficult.
I was going to say, I'd be scared to walk on it. I'd have to have my spikes or something.
That production was originally done in Los Angeles. When I was working at the Los Angeles Philharmonic, it was the L.A. Phil in the pit, Zubin Mehta conducting. And it was, I can't remember who the Tristan and Isolde were. But at the dress rehearsal, one of them rolled into the pit because it was so steep.
I could see that happening. It was getting me nervous.
We almost lost them completely. It was incredible. But that was David's sort of idea, that you would have this real sense of perspective. Mm-hmm. And of course, it looks beautiful when they're not wobbling. But they did pretty well, actually, I think, in Chicago. That production's been around since the late 80s now.
I really enjoyed it. So now for those people, I was just going to assume, and just talk about the shows you have. But then I realized when I brought an actor friend of mine who's been in Chicago 5 years, who's never been here, how beautiful the place is. And we walked around, and he was just blown away by it. So for those, 10 or 12 people who have not been to Ravinia, tell us about the atmosphere, what people can expect. Because it's more than just coming to sit and listen to a concert.
Right. It is a lot more than that. So it's a really great question, and one that we've been thinking about a lot around here, sort of what is the Ravinia experience and what does it mean? Well, at the end of the day, the Ravinia experience means whatever it is to any person who's coming. It's kind of like the old film Rashomon, right? Somebody comes here for a performance, and depending on how they deal with the dining part of things, bring their own picnic, eat in one of our elegant restaurants, grab a burger, grab a margarita, grab a beer, grab a salad, sit on the lawn, sit in the pavilion, sit in the Martin Theater, walk around all night, like a lot of people do, have a kind of party atmosphere experience, or a sit still in a seat and enjoy the music kind of experience. All of those experiences are happening simultaneously, not to mention the 30-plus pieces of beautiful sculpture, the great trees.
You're outdoors. You're out in the...
It's very special indeed.
And people, I notice, come in groups.
They do.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that going on. And especially with social networking, you'll find that there usually is one person within a group of friends who's kind of the organizer for events. And we sell a lot of tickets to that person for their friends. And, of course, we were built by a train company. So still one of our greatest advantages is that the train literally stops at the front door.
Yeah, 1904.
Yes. I was working here then. I was... 20 years old at the time, so I've lived long. We also have the Fountain of Youth here.
It's easy to get to. You have a lot of parking places.
And
I've taken the train here, too.
Yeah.
Train get literally right in front of the door, and you get out of the train, and you're in the park.
And here's the other part that I think, because we've been the summer home of the Chicago Symphony since 1936, and even before that, they were in residence as the pit orchestra for the opera, that we were the Ravinia Opera for almost two decades prior to 31. I think that kind of long-haired, classical music, I got to wear a suit, I've got to be very formal, I've got to be very quiet kind of feeling sometimes clouds the place a little bit for people who've not been here before.
Yeah, I've heard that. They say, well, it's all classical music and it's
North
just people, drinking champagne. Although there is that, too. I've seen the butler with the champagne bottle, like right out of a movie you expect to see. Richard Burton and Liz Taylor there.
That's right.
I've seen that, and I've seen families coming there with a barbecue and guy eating a hamburger.
That's right. Well, one of the things about the Camelot is that we had plenty of people in the pavilion who were in jackets, maybe not so many ties, but were nicely dressed, summer wear, who'd had a beautiful luxury, four-course supper in one of our restaurants. And then there were plenty of people on the lawn and children who'd brought a bucket of the chicken that I probably can't say on the air, but the chicken I'm talking about, now grilled. And and did it a little less expensively and a little less formally and had equally a great time.
So let's talk about price, because you have these $10 ticket programs, and I was reading on the Ravinia.org website, by the way, folks, this has all the information you'd want. The average ticket price is $25.
That's right, and it has been since 2007. And a lot of folks wonder what that actually means. What is an average ticket price? And that's a little bit complicated, but in a nutshell, our prices range from $3 to $95. And we have different places where you can sit and enjoy the performance, inside the pavilion, inside the Martin Theater.
3,200 seats in the pavilion. And literally, I didn't think it was that many. And I kind of walked around, you know, before you opened and kind of like stood or sat in a different seat just to see. And the stage is so big that I don't see a bad seat.
No, it's really good. And there are no pillars either.
So right, no pillars.
It's a completely clean viewing area. It does work very well, and the acoustics are great, too. In fact, most of the sound you hear in the pavilion for a performance like Camelot is the real sound. It's all ambient sound, not acoustic, not amplified sound. But, of course, it's amplified on the lawn, and the lawn can seat up to 13,000, 14,000 as well. So the price part is we simply take the revenue that we earn in any given year and divide it by the number of tickets we've sold, and that's how we get an average price, average ticket spend, like a restaurant would, an average cost.
Sure.
So that $25 has stayed stable now for the last 3 years.
So it is possible for people to get inexpensive tickets on the pavilion.
Absolutely.
Now, so it isn't just the lawn.
We have 4 Chicago Symphony Orchestra concerts this summer that's $25 every seat in the pavilion.
Wow.
Yeah. And $10 in the lawn for those. So it's quite a deal. Now, I think one of those might already be sold out, one of the Tchaikovsky concert, I believe, on the 12th of July. But there's a Mahler Symphony, Mahler's Ninth Symphony, one of the masterpieces of the canon. There's a great, great concert, and the one that I'm looking forward to more than almost any other, where 3 young pianists are each playing a Russian piano concerto, the Shostakovich First Concerto, the Prokofiev First Concerto, and the Rachmaninoff First Concerto. And that's a $25 ticket as well. So there are some great bargains. And speaking of music theater, in addition to this wonderful Lerner and Lowe evening that we had, we've got 3 more evenings that music theater fans might enjoy. First of all, a concert with the Chicago Symphony, all Kurt Weill with Patti LuPone singing.
All Kurt Weill. She's Patty's perfect for that, yeah.
Exactly. In fact, she said to me the other day, she goes, I don't know why I haven't done this more. It fits perfectly with who I am, what my voice is about. In fact, she is more of a Lottie Lenya type, you know, Kurt Weill's wife, than almost any other. And he wrote virtually all of those roles for
her,
Lottie.
Yes, that's true.
And so she's excited about that. She'll do the 7 Deadly Sins, and then she'll do a group of songs from his Broadway period. So you get both the Berlin period, when he was writing with Bertolt Brecht, and then when he came to the United States to escape the Nazis, the works that he wrote for Broadway, everything from Lost in the Stars to pieces from Lady in the Dark and all sorts of wonderful things.
Yeah,
so that's
going
to be a great night. Then we have a Cole Porter evening with David Hyde Pierce and Victoria Clark. You know Vicky, right?
From
Light in the Piazza?
Sure.
So they do a Cole Porter evening that's very, very special. It had its debut at Jazz at Lincoln Center, this beautiful theater, that wonderful theater in right on Central Park, actually at the Columbus Circle corner there. Wonderful, wonderful show. Great way for people to experience Cole Porter. And David, there's just no one like him. I mean, he is Cole Porter in a lot of ways.
Oh, yes.
And then a Rodgers and Hammerstein evening with the stars of Lincoln Center's production of South Pacific, Kelly O'Hara and Paulo Jatte, and that's on September 6th. And there are very low price tickets for all 3 of those performances.
Well, that's good. And you get the information, a little commercial on the Ravinia site. You literally have something going almost every night.
We're pretty busy. It's about 120 events in about 90 days, because we have some days that are double days as well.
Yeah, and the last couple of years, it's been over 600,000 people.
That's right. Since about 2001, 2002, we've been averaging around 600,000 people coming this summer.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the other stuff besides the classical and the Broadway.
Sure.
You got some good jazz.
We do.
You got folk, a lot of pop, and even some cabaret.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah,
tell
exactly
us about those.
Well, the jazz I'm particularly happy with. If you look at the Montreux or Montreal Jazz Festival lineups for this summer, and those are the 2 granddaddy jazz festivals in the world, followed closely by Monterey in California. But if you look at their lineups, you will see a lot of the names that we have that are performing jazz for us, from Pink Martini with Michael Feinstein to Tony Bennett to Diana Krall to this wonderful Miami-based Cuban band called Tiempo Libre that's doing a concert with James Galway, a sort of Latin classical evening that's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, that sounds interesting.
Very, very special. We've got terrific world music. Goran Bregovic is a fantastic artist that not a lot of folks are familiar with. He'll be here coming up very soon, I think this Sunday, actually, June 14th. This is it's hard to say it's gypsy music. This is a guy that sort of brings a musical tradition and then makes his own spin on it from all over Romania and Hungary and
so the Eastern European,
exactly.
Yeah.
And it's a great show. A really
I've listened to some of that. That's unique music.
It is completely unique, and we're going to have quite an audience for that. Femi Kuti and King Sunny Ade, sort of two generations of the Afrobeat, Afropop type music from Nigeria. Wonderful, wonderful artists. They're doing a double bill on the 1st of July. And then we're celebrating Abraham Lincoln as well this summer.
Well, tell us about
that. A lot of musical ways of paying tribute to this greatest of American presidents. This Friday, June 12th, Ramsey Lewis will bring us world premiere commission from Ravinia. His take not only on Lincoln, but also on the Lincoln legacy, more importantly. Ramsey feels strongly that a lot of the great African-American musics that America's known for, jazz, gospel, blues, spirituals, wouldn't have existed without which that Lincoln did with the Emancipation Proclamation, and now feels that with an African-American president in the White House, we have even more reason to celebrate Lincoln. So that's going to be a very special night. At the end of the summer, we've got a dance theater production from the Bill T. Jones Arne Zane Dance Company. You may know Bill T. from his Tony Award for Spring Awakening.
Yes.
But he's been around as a modern dance lion and very controversial artist, very exciting artist, someone who's been courageous enough to take on very big topics, and Lincoln's a pretty big topic.
Yes.
He workshopped the work for us for a couple weeks in May, and it's going to be a thrill. This is going to be not only one of the high points of our 2009 summer, but I think in the entire 105-year history that really has been around. This is one of the big deals. The press we've received, the interest in this.
Do you happen to know the date?
September 17 is the world premiere. September 19 we have a performance as well.
Okay. Wow.
So that's going to be a big deal indeed. Yeah. We have our gala, which is with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, kind of a perfect classical music work to celebrate everything that Lincoln was about, brotherhood, freedom. And that'll be preceded by Aaron Copland's masterpiece and probably the most famous work about Abraham Lincoln portrait, and that'll be narrated by probably the greatest diva of our time, Jesse Norman.
Wow.
Who hasn't been with us for a while, so we're excited about hearing that very unique voice and persona take on these great words of Lincoln
with Aaron Copland's music. That sounds terrific. Also, I saw a few others for the people who like things a little bit lighter.
Sure.
Indigo Girls.
That's right.
Joe Cocker.
That's right.
Jones.
Joe Cocker to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Woodstock.
Yeah.
Joe is one of the few still around.
Yeah, that's true.
That summer.
When I told a friend, he said, "Who's Joe Cocker?" And I said, go watch the Woodstock DVD.
Exactly.
Yeah,
there
he was one of the main.
I just heard him play in California. The man is in amazing shape.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Especially to survive that lifestyle.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, but the Stones are still around, right? I mean, a lot of these guys are still around. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, it is. So Tom Jones, the Beach Boys, an evening with the Beach Boys.
Always a fun evening.
Steve Miller Band.
Elvis Costello and the Sugar Canes. Yeah. This is an evening. Elvis has a new album out. He did a country album a while back. This is really a bluegrass album with one of the greatest bluegrass artists around, Jerry Douglas, who runs Union Station, which is Alison Krauss's band.
Yes.
They collaborated on this album as musicians. T-Bone Burnett, who produced and wrote a lot of the material for the Alison Krauss Robert Plant album, Raising Sand, which took all the Grammys. T-Bone has done this album as well, and that's going to be a really great night. So the first half is Elvis and bluegrass. The second half is all the Elvis Costello hits. That's a concert in August.
Wow, that's really... Then you have a Gershwin and Leonard Bernstein evening?
That's right. An all-American program with Christoph Eschenbach conducting Simone Bartow and a group of young string players from the Philadelphia area. They're called Time for Three. It's the violin, two violins and bass. Violin, violin, bass, I can never remember. Maybe they switch off. It's two smaller string instruments and a bass player. and not ukulele, though. It's definitely violin or viola. Anyway, they're playing the Chicago premiere of a work by one of the hottest composers around, a young lady named Jennifer Higdon. We commissioned Jenny to do a piece for us back for our centennial, and we're really happy to have back a work called Concerto 4-3, the numbers. So it's 4-3, it's a play on words. They'll do that. Simone Bartow will play... the Concerto in F of Gershwin, and then we'll have the Bernstein Symphonic Dances. And we also have the Gershwin Concerto, Rhapsody in Blue, with Herbie Hancock and Long Long playing together. That's
wow.
our concert with the CSL coming up in July.
Yeah, that'll
look like Gershwin.
A Night in Vienna, yeah. Waltzes and Songs.
Always fun.
Yeah.
Always fun.
Let's see, I had a couple more. You've mentioned so many. The Four Tops,
yes.
And the Temptations.
Oh, you know, that one always brings them out. And, you know, who knows if any of them are original anymore. I think one or two of them might be, but it's always a great concert.
Well, the sound is there. The doo-wop right. sound is, that's right. is fantastic. You mentioned the Cole Porter Evening. Tony Bennett.
Yeah.
He's
82.
He's, yeah.
Going strong. Sounding better than ever.
Is I mean, that right?
Tony is the first concert I ever heard live. I was 5 years old. It was back in San Francisco at the old Fairmont Hotel in the Venetian Room. And my
he used to play that a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this guy has had such a magical career and has kept his voice in pristine shape and still brings him in. I mean, people just really want to hear him.
Wow. Then you have some of the country stuff. Carrie Underwood, yeah. Lionel Lovett.
Yeah. And even Bonnie Raitt. Bonnie is not really country so much, though there's always been a bit of a twang.
Yeah,
in her
she's
voice.
Kinda, yeah,
she's got more a, folk.
Yeah, more
folk
folky,
rock,
yeah.
I would say. Yeah. But and blues, of course. But yeah. she's always had a love for country music. She'll be here with Taj Mahal for two evenings. That's going to be a great, great blues evening. And you're right, Carrie Underwood. We're thrilled to have her be making her debut. John Legend, not in the country field, but John is. I think John's kind of the Tony Bennett of the 30-year-old set.
You know, I've never heard him. As somebody was telling me today when I was mentioning who's coming to Ravinia, and I meant he's, oh, you got to see him. So I'll have to get out here for that.
And India Ari is going to open for him. It's going to be one of the more special evenings. It sold out so fast, we added a second show. Same thing happened with Carrie Underwood.
Wow.
We also have a guy named Hershey Felder.
Do yes, I was just going to mention.
Yeah.
I've been
in the theater.
Hershey's been on this podcast.
It's a great interview.
Yes. Oh, when he did the Gershwin show.
Yeah.
I know, I'm sure you've seen that.
We brought that here, actually.
Did you?
We brought, he's done Gershwin, he's done Chopin.
Yes.
Now he'll do Beethoven.
I have
us.
Not, I don't think the Beethoven's been
it's
done.
It's not been in Chicago
okay,
yet.
Okay, so I'm so sure you'll get all the reviewers out.
I think he did it in L.A., and I think he started it at the Old Globe in San Diego.
He was going to start it here, and he got burned out right. from, you know, when he was doing the ball. Any one of them would wear anyone out, but he was doing the Chopin and the Gershwin. In repertory, and I think it just burned him physically, yeah. burned him out.
It's so, a lot. I mean, yeah. because to do all of the dialogue that he does, all the speaking, all the acting that he does, and then sit down and play.
And he's a super musician.
Fantastic musician. Yeah. But those are two different things to do.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, how many people can actually do that on a regular basis? It's really, really hard. With classical rap, I mean, Victor Borge used to do it.
But he was more comic, yeah.
He is
didn't
comic,
really play
but he's a great player.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
an
amazing
yeah.
pianist. But he didn't play as much as Hershey does in yeah. his shows.
Well, Hershey was planning on doing all three in repertoire.
Yeah.
Maybe someday he will,
yeah.
but boy, I don't. Yeah. But I've got to make sure I get out for that. He's got two nights of the Beethoven.
That's right. I believe it's September 4 and 5.
Yeah, that's what I've got.
So Friday and Saturday.
If I copied it right off your site.
And, you know, the Martin Theater is a great place to hear a concert. There are a lot of folks, as we were talking about, perceptions of Ravinia that
yeah.
think it's only the lawn
yeah.
or only the pavilion. Very informal, very formal. The Martin Theater is something that people should really treat themselves with. The prices, again, are very inexpensive, but it's only 850 seats. But it feels like about 400 seats. I mean, the intimacy of the place.
Because yeah, that's about the size of the Goodman, 850.
That's right.
Yeah.
Though it feels even smaller because there's no balcony,
okay.
and it's a building from 1904. It's the only building from the original park. The acoustics are the best in the Chicagoland area by far.
Oh.
And every artist that I bring in there for the first time when they go in for a sound check, whether it's Kiri Takanawa or Barbara Cook, and I say, so how many seats do you think this is? They all guess 3 or 350. They
wow.
can't believe it's 850. In the pavilion, they all guess between 1,000 and 1,500.
I thought about 1819 when
yeah.
I looked at it.
It's one of the magic things about it. Part of it is that there's no balcony, so it's all flat. But it's also kind of an optic thing. You just feel close to the stage. And in the pavilion, as you said earlier, the stage is so huge.
Yeah. Wow. So that's a trick, because I've never been to that theater.
You must
Good.
Do it.
Oh,
well,
yeah,
you will for Hershey.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Something very special happening in there as well, if I might, is
sure.
And that is truly international in quality. Not that everything we do isn't, but this is a very special thing, especially for the classical music lovers. There are three great Schubert song cycles, and rarely do they get done by the same performer. They're very daunting things to take on. They're not particularly long, but just the memorization alone is tough for any singer. And they're great stories, They're usually a group of anywhere from 18 to 30 songs that range in length from 90 seconds to 5 minutes. And we're very lucky this summer that the great, great pianist and our former music director, Christoph Eschenbach, will be playing the piano for one of the most dynamic. We were talking earlier about opera singers who can act.
Yes.
Matthias Gerne. This is somebody who is a great Papageno in Magic Flute, an amazing Tannhäuser, and amazing Wolfram in Tannhäuser. Just a great actor all the way around. But he doesn't need a costume or a set to do it. And these are mini operas in their own way. They're
when
great
is that?
Stories. This is the last week of July. I believe it's a Monday, a Wednesday, and a Friday. So it's a different cycle every night.
Okay.
And he's going to be accompanied by the great Christoph Eschenbach. This is really a don't-miss thing, and I would heartily recommend to you that if you can catch at least one of those.
Yeah, I'm going
to
try and catch at least one.
But you were talking about prices earlier. There are great packages, very inexpensive packages to get all three, and I think in some cases supper and parking are included as well. So it's a great bargain. This is the kind of thing that happens at the Lucerne Festival, at the Edinburgh Festival, at the Salzburg Festival, the great classical music festivals of Europe that everybody wants to have happen. And we're very fortunate. This is the only time in America it's going to happen. And they're also recording all of these works as well. So it's a chance for people to get a kind of dynamism in a intimate stage situation where typically this would be done in a place like Carnegie Hall, which is about 3,100 seats.
Wow.
So to get that kind of intimacy and these great artists really at their peak, it's pretty exciting.
You know, one of the folks, I got to add this because since this is audio,
I don't have to sing.
You have been giving us all this detail and no notes. I'm amazed by that.
Oh, well.
I mean, and I've done a lot of these interviews, and generally, you know, and I have some notes. You know, that's part of doing your homework. But you really have you really are into this thing, and you have a tremendous memory.
Well,
wow.
I appreciate that. Look, you know, people often ask me, what am I really looking forward to this summer? And as my colleagues on the staff know, it's hard for me to come up with a couple of special things because, you know, if I don't want to go, why would I book it?
Okay.
Because I love all kinds of music,
and you're ultimately the person that books it.
Okay. You know, I had a classical training with piano, but also I was a rehearsal pianist in the musical theater world from about age 10.
So now I see where that interest comes.
I played in jazz band from the third grade through college. I had my own rock band, quote unquote rock band, really terrible, horrible band that played for sort of junior high proms and things like that. I think the theme from Rocky was our big hit. We did some Earth, Wind, and Fire covers. you know how old I am. But I love all kinds of musics. I am very omnivorous when it comes to my approach to music, and I don't think of one type of music being better than another.
Well, so, what you've done in the last, is your ninth year here?
Correct.
What you have done with diversifying and just making this place, I look at the schedule. Every time I show people the schedule, you know, you want to size a circle something if you're interested in, and you end up with almost every night.
Well, that's nice.
Do you have people that come quite often?
We have folks that come five nights a week.
Wow.
Yeah.
And every night, of course, it's so different you can easily do that.
We also have a lot of folks who walk up to the box office and say, I'll take two of whatever you're doing tonight. It's a beautiful night. They know they want to go to Ravinia and just experience it. And I guess that's what I would really stress for folks that haven't come. Once they get their foot in the door, they're going to be hooked.
Yeah.
Because it is a gorgeous experience. And just to walk around, especially, interestingly, on a Martin Theater night, let's say the Juilliard String Quartet is playing a concert. You can be on the lawn, $10 to get in, have some supper, bring it yourself, sit on the lawn, or just, I see people strolling around, listening to Haydn or Beethoven or Schumann, having the most marvelous time. And we usually have, at the most, a couple hundred people on the lawn. And it's about 30 acres of lawn, so you can really have a place to yourself. It's an extremely romantic way to spend an evening, beautiful, hushed way to do it, and you have this great music being piped out from some of the great performers of the world.
Well, in the interest of time, we're just about over. Tell us what some of your plans are for the future. I can see that you're an innovator, and you're a guy that's not going to stand still.
Well, I always start programming with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. That is the crown jewel of the festival, has been for 70 plus years and continues to be. So a lot of that is already in place. I'm not at liberty to speak about a lot of that because we really like to get that kind
of information
to our donors.
Yeah.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
It also takes up a lot of the occupancy of the pavilion between rehearsals and concerts, and so it really needs to be slotted in. Also, I have a limited time that I have with the orchestra, and it's pretty the parameters are set years in advance based on their touring and what their downtown schedule is like. So it's pretty, I know now exactly where they're going to fall, for instance, in 2012, and start booking artists. Also, classical artists will book farther ahead than pop artists or jazz artists. Okay. That doesn't usually begin until November or December.
Can you give us a hint on what you're going to do with theater?
I'll give you a little hint about what the season is shaping up to be. Okay. 2010 is a summer and a year that has quite a number of notable anniversaries in it.
Okay.
Everything from the 200th birthdays of Robert Schumann and Frédéric Chopin to the 100th birthday of Samuel Barber, one of the great composers of all time and some of the most beautiful music used in opera and film all the time. It's the 20th anniversary of the passing of both Leonard Bernstein and Aaron Copland, two of the giants of American music.
Yes.
1990 was a truly tragic year for all of us that work in classical music. It is the 100th anniversary of the passing and 150th anniversary of the birth of Gustav Mahler.
Okay.
It's the 80th birthday of Steve Sondheim.
Yes, that I know. He's coming to town. I know that.
Yes, he is. He's coming in March.
So you're going to do a – you got to do something.
Well, we're going to do something special for him.
Okay.
I don't know exactly what it's going to be, but I will tell you that I've been in conversations with six people who've been key to the success that we've had in looking at and celebrating Steve's work, and those six people are – Patti LuPone, George Hearn, Otter McDonald, and Michael Cerveris as vocalists, and Lonnie Price and Paul Gemignani, director and conductor. So we're hatching something that I think is going to be a very special one-night-only kind of thing.
Get great performances out so that it has a legacy.
We're talking about it. It's,
okay.
It's tough to do, and
I know.
TV is just really tough all the way around, but I appreciate that. In fact, the Bill T. Jones piece will be on TV. I mean,
good.
PBS is going to pick that up.
Good.
We are having a film made about the creation of this work. So it won't be a film of the performance that Bill will do for us. It's more of a making of.
Well, those are great. A lot of people, I love those. Yeah. Documentaries are
so
great.
So American Masters will air that sometime, we think, in the winter of 2011. It's a very exciting project. In fact, it's the unbelievable film production company, Kartemkin, who did Hoop Dreams.
Oh, yes.
They're directing, producing, writing this particular film. So that's
really
exciting.
Well, we're almost out of time, and I'm just blown away by your the command of this. The Ravinia Festival, folks, is in great hands, and thanks for your time.
Thank you so
much. And I always end, folks, by saying, go see a play this week, and that's true. Get to Ravinia this week.
Absolutely.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of June 15th, 2009. Chicago's nationally renowned storefront and black box theater community gathered at the Park West for its annual celebration as the Jeff Awards Committee gave out 26 non-equity awards in 24 categories. The event was emceed by actor John Steinhagen, who enjoyed his third time in the role. Top Jeff Awards honors for Outstanding Production in a Play went to The Hypocrites' Our Town, and for a musical went to Theo Ubique's Evita. Evita also walked away with a total of 6 awards, the most for any single production of the night. Directing honors also went to Fred Anzavino for Evita and to David Cromer for Our Town. The highly coveted Outstanding Ensemble Award went to Steep Theater's In Arabia, We'd All Be Kings, a tale of the transformation of Manhattan's Hell's Kitchen. Rogers Park venues walked off with the lion's share of the awards, taking in a total of 11 of the 24 categories. Principal actor honors went to Chris Damiano for Evita, who also took home a second award for the best supporting actor in a musical. He was also the only individual to take home multiple awards that evening. Principal Actress Awards went to Maggie Portman for Evita and Laura Coover for Blue Surge by Eclipse Theater Company. Best New Work honors went to Trapdoor Theater for Beholder. Best New Adaptation went to Lifeline Theater for The Mark of Zorro. And a special award was given to Arlene Crudson, who we also interviewed here recently, and you can find the interview on our website. For a complete list of the 2009 Non-Equity Jeff Award recipients and other statistics of the evening, click on over to Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. Don Helsing, who was once the executive director of the Court Theater, is now the new managing director for the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. Helsing, who left Court back in January, will be taking over for Timothy Shields and starts in August. Congratulations, Don Helsing. Also, the Milwaukee Repertory Theater is looking for a replacement for their departing artistic director, who leaves next year. You interested? Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Wells Kaufman for giving us the honor of interviewing him this week. I would also like to thank Tom Williams and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And I would also like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we will be here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.